Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. On the heels of my one-year anniversary last year and inviting Paul Daniel to say hello, here I am without Jason. It's always hard, but I bring back a favorite with me, my editor. I'm not just saying that because he's my editor. Burl Love is joining me today while Jason is off. Hi, Burl.
How are you?
I'm good. Doing a lot of writing.
You were part of a huge news event this week. Today, in particular, weren't you? The reopening of hair salons?
I was.
So for our listeners, of course, we've been working hard to cover the gradual reopening. And we've had reporters and photographers out at stores and today at hair salons, but you weren't just reporting on the story, Sherry. You were one of the people who have been waiting desperately to get your hair done. Is that right? How did it go?
It is. I have to say, so my editor, Carl, who just mentioned here, he was, you know, kind of planning out. So we're recording on Friday just because of like a lot of off time for myself and Jason and Silent Phil. We're going to give him a little break. He has definitely earned it with Jason and I, like corralling us. Full-time job, Phil. I know.
Hazard pay.
So with some time off, we're recording a little bit early. Our special guest today is Chris Seelbach. I don't want to, leave that out. I honestly feel like he's the kind of guest that needs no introduction. We talk about him on the podcast all the time, and this is going to be his first appearance. So it is, we're recording on a Friday. Carl, beginning of the week, says, okay, well, you know, how are we going to cover this? It is, you know, the politics team, Hannah Sparling, Scott Wortman, our Columbus reporters, Jesse Jackie, everyone. This is everyone. And I was like, well, I'll be out in the morning because I'm going to get my hair done. And he was like, I'm going to need you to write about that experience.
So
I did do that.
What was it like? I mean, you weren't allowed to talk. Is that correct? You have to.
We did
is
talk
that true?
So much less. I didn't know what to expect. I've been the kind of person, and we've talked about that here too on the podcast, very serious stay at home follower. And so I haven't really been out that much. Have a selection of masks, haven't really worn them yet because I haven't needed to. So a lot of precautions. And so it was interesting to see what that was going to be like. There was a lot of rules that had to be followed. So I wore a mask. The person who did my hair, Cassie Doyle, wore a mask. She also wore a shield. It's the kind of thing where you get in somebody's, you are up close with them.
Right.
Like you can social distance between people getting their hair done. But it's just an intimate thing, right? And I realized that you build a trust level. That is going to be like the most important thing, like going back, because I know she's been social distancing and I trust her to clean. There were so many cleaning products. And
did you get screened before you went in? Did you have to have your temperature taken and things like that?
She asked me to do that myself because she trusts me, and I did do that. I have, like, and I'm sure that we'll be doing that much more. I have, like, a nice thermometer finally coming in the mail, but I use the old one for Jack, like, that we had when he was a baby, to take my temperature this morning, so I knew. And honestly, in some cases, it's going to be better to know before you leave the house, because you don't want to get somewhere and have them take your temperature.
And, that's right.
And well, then be like, no.
It's just been fascinating to watch our collective impatience with staying at home. You know, I think a lot of us are in a different mental space and are going to, you know, we've had stories about how if you look at everything from cell phone data that tracks our movement to the number of cars on the highways, we are going out again. You know, people are trying to get back to normal as much as they can. Are you going to try to find a patio dining location this weekend, assuming it's not raining?
I'm going to wait just a little bit, but, yeah. You know, I have some compromised lungs. I had a lung infection last year. I mentioned that in passing. So I need to be a little bit more careful, but I do think that people should be able to make their own choices. And I'm seeing that happen with all of the proper restrictions. I feel like that's going to be the big story coming, like, as we keep covering this. Like, what does, I think we're learning as we go. Like, the person who did my hair this morning built in so much more time to clean, but it's a small space. And she's like, I guess I'm not going to need that much time to clean. We'll just learn as we go of what needs to be done. And we can't stop living. I do think that.
Well, I got a text message from the person who cuts my hair saying, okay, I'm going to be open. You can schedule appointments. And I looked at myself in the mirror and realized, you know, I haven't shaved since the stay-at-home guidelines came out. I'm growing a Corona beard along with our friend Carl.
And I looked at myself. I've seen that on Zoom call.
I looked at myself and I thought, you know, what's the point of getting my hair cut when the front of my face looks like it does? So I think I'm just going to keep it up until, you know, we actually return to the kind of a normal business, situation where, you know, I'm getting dressed up and going to work again. I'm not in any hurry to go to my stylist, unfortunately. I might have to just Venmo her some money just because I feel bad
for it. Like some of the people who do like the beauty services that I'm so used to, I did support them a little bit. Like that, they asked people to do that, and I did think that was the right thing to do because it was money I wasn't spending, and that's just a way to keep the economy going, and I want them to stay doing what they're doing and doing what they love.
I was saying my heart goes out to the people who rely on, you know, people moving about for their livelihood. It's been tough on so many people, but especially anyone who's in the, you know, the restaurant industry, the, you know, general, you know, service industry and things like that. It has been hard. They have not been working. They've been, in some cases, struggling to get answers to their unemployment claims. So, my hat's off to anyone who's taken advantage of some of those GoFundMes and other ways people have been, trying to keep some sort of cash flow coming in because it's been a challenge. So maybe I should go get my hair trimmed up. I think I've talked myself into it.
All right. I feel like I'm going to get a thank you note from Lauren, your fiance. I'm not just guessing.
I don't think she likes it, but she's in full support of the Corona beard challenge just to see how ridiculous it gets.
Well, at this point, there is some of that for sure, right? Like, well, how long can we do such and such, right? Are you going to go out this weekend and get something to eat? Patios only at this point, but we're getting to the point where...
Right.
Inside dining.
Probably not. We'll probably do carry out. We've been really good at, it's just nice not to cook at home all the time, but also just part of the, you know, what we can do to help others in the pandemic is to support, especially, you know, locally owned small restaurants that are doing carry out. So we've explored some places that we hadn't been to before that have been fun just around our neighborhood. But we discovered a new Indian restaurant we hadn't been to and things like that. So we'll probably continue that streak of finding some fun carry out to get, you know, unless the weather, and of course this is going to air after the rainy weekend, so we don't know, but I think that's the sad part is everybody's working to get these patios opened up. We have like a full weekend of rain on the forecast, so we just can't catch a break. But
more Cincinnati than that, though, that it's going to rain when we don't want it to rain. Now, come on, that is a very Cincinnati thing.
that is so Cincinnati. So anyway, well, should we get to our guest?
Yes, absolutely. So now it's time for our special guest segment. Somebody, I think, longtime listeners, we've mentioned him a lot of times before on the podcast, but this is his first time as a guest. Welcome, Chris Fieldbach, councilman.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
This is long overdue, I think.
No, I've been wanting to come on, especially with you and Burl.
All right. I think that it's probably not a secret that you don't get along with my usual guest host. He knows it and you know it. And, you know, I do feel like if you got along, Twitter would be a much more boring place.
I guess you're right. And because Jason's, you know, not here this week, we can talk about him. So it's fair game. Yeah. I'll answer any question you have.
You know, we do like guests to talk a little bit about themselves, though. And, you know, your history is so interesting. I want to take people all the way back, okay. You know, because it's with you, it's like every week there's something new, but let's go all the way back. You know, okay. See your university, coming to Cincinnati and what the city means to you. Can you kind of tell me about that time?
Yeah, so I was raised in Louisville, Kentucky, actually a suburb of Louisville called Pleasure Ridge Park. And so at 18, so I guess this is kind of the prelude to it. I came out the day after I graduated high school. My parents asked me if I was gay, and I told them the truth. And then in that summer between high school and college, I was in conversion therapy. And so then I came to Cincinnati, Ohio in August of 1998 and didn't know a single person. Went to Xavier University. And, you know, that's what led me to Cincinnati. I wanted to go to a smaller college. And I actually, throughout my senior year of high school, I had thought I was going to Center College in Danville, Kentucky. I had a bumper sticker and everything. But then at the last minute decided that I didn't want to be in the middle of nowhere, Kentucky. I wanted to be in some kind of city. And so switched to Xavier. And so then that's what led me to Cincinnati in 1998. And I've been here ever since. So I've been here longer than I was in Louisville.
Were you really out then? Like, it was a different time, of course.
Totally different.
So, I mean, how would you say, because I feel like some of your, you know, push to make things equal, it did start then. Like, how much Absolutely. Did you own that?
I mean, you know, I've talked about this a lot, but coming out for me was not a good process. And, you know, I didn't talk to my parents for 11 years after coming out. They're amazing now. They're my biggest advocates and biggest allies. They're incredibly great allies to the LGBTQ+ community. But that was not the case 22 years ago. And so I had an incredibly difficult time. It absolutely is the driver of my life, my relationship with my parents. Especially that the relationship that changed after I came out. And so, yeah, it was extremely difficult because not only my parents, but my entire family, even those who wanted to support me, really didn't, because, you know, they didn't want to make my parents mad. And so, you know, we've all moved on from that, but it is absolutely the driver of what I do and why I fight for those who don't have a fair shot. You know, I get it. I get that, you know, not everyone is on an equal playing field. Not everyone has the same opportunities. And, you know, what I have fought for, you know, I think you're going to mention this, but my colleague surprised me when the National Humane Society gave me their Legislator of the Year award this couple months ago. And I was caught completely off guard. And I said that, you know, the things that are most important to me are protecting gay kids and animals. And it really was this raw moment of like, that really is kind of like the fundamental thing that I care about is, you know, protecting, ensuring the kids don't go through what I went through, and then animals. So, you know, I've reflected on how that came out and what it means. And it really is kind of a fundamental thing to me.
There's still surprises. Oh, sorry, bro, go ahead.
No, that's okay. Your experience coming out, obviously driving everything that you've pushed for equal rights for humans. Can you touch a little bit about what motivates you and what the, you know, what's the inspiration to fight on behalf of our four-legged friends?
Yeah, I mean, I've loved animals from the moment I was able to communicate that. When I was 5 years old in preschool, it was called Mother's Day Out back then, which was like so sexist because it assumed that like, you know, mothers were at home raising the kids and they needed a day off, which my mom was. But we had a lesson on where food came from. Miss Billy Joe was my teacher's name. And I learned that some food came from animals. And from that moment on, I have never eaten meat in my life since I was 5 years old. So I have just always loved animals. I was raised with Cocker Spaniels. growing up. And my parents will tell you I've rescued like so many, everything from a pig that was like running in the street to dogs and cats. And I've just always loved animals. You know, they're not judgmental, and they just play such a, you know, awesome, happy role in our life. And so when I got my first apartment, they didn't allow dogs. I'd never had a cat. I'd rescued them, but never had one. And they only allowed cats in my first apartment. So I got a cat. And then Craig and I ended up with 5 cats. And they've all passed away. Our last one passed away just a couple months ago at 21. And we have 3 new kittens right now, which are amazing and have helped us get through all of this.
Yep. You got married in?
2018. Craig and I have been together almost 15 years. And we got married in 2018.
And you waited for a reason, right? Just right.
I mean, you know, so this is an interesting story. So, you know, I have fought for equal rights for, you know, LGBTQ people since I was 18, since I came out. And I actually just found a story or some kind of paper that I wrote in high school where I was, this is before I was out, sticking up for homosexuals, which was what people said back then. But anyway, I've always fought for marriage equality, and it's been a big thing. You know, it's not the end all, there's still a lot more to do. But so on June 26, 2015, I woke up that morning going to the funeral of Sonny Kim, the police officer who was killed in the line of duty. And I walked in the back of the Xavier Stadium, because that's where the elected officials were walking in. And as I was walking through these tunnels, there was 2 female police officers, and they were like, "Did you hear? Did you hear?" And I'm like, "What?" And they said, "The Supreme Court just ruled that marriage equality is the law of the land." And I mean, I cannot tell you what a moment that was for me. It almost makes me cry right now. I walked into the stadium, and I sat next to the then Vice Mayor David Mann, who has his own story. David was not always supportive of LGBT equality, and his own son came out, and he had a revolution. And so I sat next to the father of a gay son, and I just wept. People probably thought I was, you must have been really close to Sonny Kim, but I cried my eyes out. And it was such a moment for, you know, me to sit beside a man who wasn't always on my side and had this evolution and now was a proud father of a gay son. And now I'm sitting, you know, as a gay man who can now get married. And I never thought that was ever possible growing up, ever. Never thought I would ever even be able to be in a relationship.
Got married in Mexico, right?
Who
officiated? Yeah.
Yvette Simpson, who is our really good friend and who I, you know, was hoping was going to be the mayor right now. But she officiated, and, you know, we had lots of Molly Wellman and lots of people you might recognize were on our wedding party. We fell in love with Puerto Vallarta about 6 years ago. And, you know, we wanted a smaller wedding so we could actually enjoy it. So we had 70 people and it was amazing. It was, you know, there was literally a hurricane that came through our wedding. There was a hurricane in Puerto Vallarta and in the middle, and we had an outdoor everything. And so in the middle of our ceremony, we had one of the most torrential downpours, you know, that I've ever experienced. So it was quite the occasion.
So speaking of Yvette, I mean, you kind of came up with this freshman class of council members in 2011. I can remember, I mean, I was covering the county then, but I can remember the picture. Jane Prendergast wrote the story of like, you know, it's the youth wave of council. It does seem like yesterday, but not exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't. So,
what has been the experience of like going through the different councils and like, and where you are now in life compared to where you were then?
Yeah. I mean, when we were running in 2011, everyone thought, you know, first of all, there was not any open seats. All 9 council members were running for election. No one thought that all 3 of us, much less maybe even 1 of us could win. And if they did, they thought it was going to be PG because he was raising tons of money. He was a well-known Cincinnati family and running a great campaign. And it went so far as Mark Mallory, the mayor, said that he would sing in public for the first time ever if both Yvette and I got elected, which he actually had to do that night. And so when we first got on, it was incredible because we unseated four conservative/Republican council members. And so there was this 7-member majority of Democrats on council, which maybe for the first time or first time in a long time. And those first 2 years were incredible, incredible. I mean, having Mark Mallory as mayor and the colleagues that I did, it was a lot of fun. We did a lot of good things. There wasn't nearly the divisiveness or fighting or, you know, it just was incredible. It was, I would give anything to have that for my entire time. But it hasn't been like that. It's been a bumpy road since 2013 when John Cranley became mayor. He has a very different style than Mark Mallory or anyone that I had worked with. It's night and day what the experience is between my first term and then the subsequent three terms. I've learned a lot. My mom always reminds me that you learn how to deal with people that are different from you and don't treat you necessarily how you'd like to be treated. And that gives you a lot of skills in life that, you know, you wouldn't have otherwise. And so I do appreciate that, but it has not been as fun or as rewarding as my first term. But the city has come so far in the last decade. I mean, this is a city that young people couldn't wait to leave, and that there wasn't restaurants and fun things to do and parks and public spaces that were, you know, so inclusive of everyone. And we have transformed our city in the last decade, not all of it. And there's always room for criticism, but this is a different city than it was a decade ago. And I think definitely for the better. And I think the census will show that we have grown for the first time in over 65 years in the last decade. So I'm proud of the work that we've done. I wish it was a more fun and easier path with my colleagues, but I appreciate what I've learned from it not being easy.
Girl, you came back, right? Like, you grew up here and came back to a very different city.
That's true. I've said this before, but when people ask me what the biggest change is, I joke that when I left, mint chocolate chip ice cream at Grater's was green, and it's not anymore. because they expect me to say, you know, to talk about over the Rhine or talk about Washington Park. But it's not just those physical locations and the reinvestment in town. It's also a completely different feel than it was when I grew up in the 80s and living in the suburbs. You came downtown for maybe a Reds game. I think we had our prom at the Westin and we all got lost on the one-way streets because none of us knew how to get around town. But that was it. And we just have such a better connection to our center now than we have in my lifetime growing up here. And it's just an incredible transformation on so many levels, not just the investment in the real estate and the physical part of it, but just the community that has popped up around it. And, you know, there's obviously challenges. I was going to ask you, Chris, to talk a little bit about the challenges with the what some call gentrification. It's more diverse, it's more inclusive, but some have been critical of what it's done to people who are poor, people who got pushed out of the neighborhood. I think that resurfaced with the FCC Stadium. Can you talk a little bit about that experience for you?
I really push back on this narrative that OTR has been gentrified in a bad way. So at its height, 50,000 people live in Over the Rhine, and it was a neighborhood that was built to accommodate 50,000 people. Currently, there are about 6,000, maybe 7,000 people who live here. A decade or so ago, probably half that. And so this narrative that somehow people were pushed out you know, there are cases of that, and there are cases of low-income people being pushed out. But, you know, these buildings, which is the largest collection of Italianate architecture in the country, were collapsing into the street. There are stories that the Inquirer did of the buildings collapsing into the street, and they weren't filled with people. They were filled with no one. They had been vacant for decades and decades. And so what 3CDC has done is largely good. They took these buildings that were going to be either needed to be torn down or were falling down and brought back life to them and brought people to them where there were no people. And, you know, that is an incredible thing. And, you know, there are absolutely cases where buildings had people that were lower income that had been turned into condos, and they were pushed out, which is not a good thing. But by and large, that's not the case. It was buildings that were vacant that are now in my own building. You know, I moved into my space that I'm in right now in 2004, and no one had lived in this building for, I think, 30 years. And so, you know, no one was pushed out. Now, I think FC is absolutely a different case. The West End, we know that people, you know, FC promised. They said, we promise that not a single person will be displaced because of the stadium. And that was a complete lie. They told us that over and over, and it was a complete 100% lie. Many people, dozens of people, have been pushed out of buildings that FC then bought around the stadium and told them that they needed to find different housing. You know, there was a huge standoff, I think about a year ago, with a woman who had many medical needs, and FC was evicting her. So, you know, that is definitely gentrification in a negative way. But by and large and over the Rhine, I think it's a false narrative that people continue to try to push that somehow it's been gentrified in a bad way. You know, the Model Group does incredible job with low-income housing in over the Rhine. OTR Housing has hundreds of low-income units that they rent out in over the Rhine. We just passed a deal with 3CDC to develop low-income housing. You know, there's always more we could do, but it's not as simple as saying, and by the way, gentrification is a word that has a negative connotation. It doesn't always mean negative, but the negative connotation with gentrification, there's more to the story than just saying OTR is gentrified the bad way.
Well, there was a lot there. Sherry, can I ask a follow-up on
absolutely, yeah.
So you've been one of the most vocal critics of how FC Cincinnati has handled the stadium development. Do you think it's fair to call them liars when if you were to ask Jeff Birding about that promise, he would say something to the effect of, you know, the actual footprint of the stadium, the land required to build the actual stadium did not place anybody, but that the subsequent run up on the land around it was you know, an effect of when you reinvest in a neighborhood, you're going to drive the prices up and there's going to be people trying to sell and make some money, and that they have just as much right as anyone else to go after some of those properties around the stadium.
Yes, that is what he would say. And I think it's bullshit. Like, I think that, you know, they came and testified in front of us and said the stadium will not displace anyone in the West End. Now, technically, the physical stadium did not displace anyone. But come on. I mean, you know, most every person would say, yeah, that's a lie. You said you're not going to displace anyone, and clearly you are. You can't just fall back on this technicality that because you said the stadium, you were meaning the physical stadium and not the subsequent purchase of many buildings around it and then evicting all the low-income people. I mean, you know,
but he would say that whether they bought it or not, that was going to happen to those people. So why not have, you know, the state, why not have the team buy some of those properties so that they can make sure that it's not surrounded by, you know, liquor stores or other things that aren't as, you know, appropriate for a place where families are going to go to watch a game. That if they didn't purchase some of those properties, somebody else would have, and then those people would have been displaced anyway.
Well, then they should have bought the buildings and ensured that low-income people could stay in them, because that's what they said they were going to do all along, that they were going to be a good partner, that they wanted this to help the West End, including the low-income people who lived there, that they didn't want to displace low-income people. So if they really wanted to do that, they should have bought the buildings and then allowed the low-income people to stay there. But no, I don't buy it. I don't buy the caveat of the physical space. Look, this is our historic Black neighborhood. They're essentially taking it over, displacing low-income African-American people and filling them with people who can afford, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in condos or, you know, and it's just, that is gentrification negatively. Let me just say this. I think the FC is incredible. What they have brought to the city is incredible. The momentum, the excitement, it is part of our renaissance, and it's incredible. I've been to a game. It's exhilarating. My problem with them is that these are billionaires. There's at least two billionaires who own the team. And by the way, this is not a nonprofit team. This is a for-profit enterprise. You know, it's great for our city, but they're doing this because they're going to make money at it. And so to ask the city taxpayers, many who are low income, for $33 million in taxpayer subsidy to help subsidize billionaires making money is ridiculous to me.
Well, I would say, you know, good for them for asking. Somebody had to vote to prove that, right?
Totally. It's on my colleagues. Well, no, okay. They shouldn't have asked. They didn't need the money. These are billionaires. They shouldn't have asked. You know, we are struggling as a city, and long before this pandemic, we've been cutting our budget. We haven't had a surplus in over a decade. We've had deficits every single year. And so for people of means, very big means, to ask the city to help subsidize them, their for-profit business, to make more money, I mean, it's unacceptable.
I do think that their argument there, I want to make a different point. Their argument back to that, just to put all sides out there, is it is for infrastructure, streets, yes, and parking and such, which is not unusual. I mean, if we look at the Kroger project downtown, if we look, GE got like $120 million in subsidies to locate at the banks,
yes,
which was trouble. So I think that's their point there. But the thing that I think that gets left out a lot of this conversation is, so I covered City Hall since 2014, and a lot of people were like, this is our historic Black neighborhood when FC came along.
Yes.
I never heard of the West End. Of course, I heard of it, but I never heard it mentioned. I didn't know who the community council president was. This is not something that the city was investing in, for as much as everyone was like, we love this neighborhood, it's important to the city. It had fallen in a lot of disrepair and needed a lot of things that other neighborhoods had been getting, and they hadn't, and maybe they didn't know how to ask. It's part of the disparity
yes
in neighborhoods.
No. I mean, City West is a project that happened in the last couple decades, and that was, you know, this mixed-use development where you had low-income housing and market-rate housing, and, you know, that was a great thing for the West End. My chief of staff, John Harmon, lives there, and most of his neighbors are low-income. So not necessarily completely abandoned, but yeah, I mean, there was not as much investment in the West End as there was over the Rhine or the Uptown area, but there had been some investment, but yes.
So I think, okay, this is a topic. I mean, I would think this is one of the biggest topics in our city, just in general. It touches on so many different points, gentrification, you know, where we want to invest, growing our city, being like this next big city, right? Of like, yep, Nashville being so maybe overgrown now, and like how we don't become that, but we grow and we become that place where people want to keep living. And so,
right.
But this is like, I think we could do 10 podcasts, and maybe we should do 10 podcasts.
You know, I have one quick question just to wrap up this, yeah, part of it, and it's fascinating, and I appreciate you sharing your opinions on this, Chris. Again, the team would say that that's not their role, and the Port Authority was put in place to address
so that they don't have to pay taxes. By the way,
well, do you think that solution is working? Are you happy with what the port has done to try to make sure that the development going forward includes a, you know, affordable housing in the mix?
Yes, I'm a huge fan of the Port Authority. I think They do tremendous work that is not noticed as much. But yeah, I think the Port Authority is doing a great job. Laura Bruner's, I think very highly of her. So I think the Port Authority is doing a great job. So yes, I'm glad that they're part of this project. I'm not going to hide behind the fact that they're the only reason they're part of this project is because they're a nonprofit organization. It allows the billionaires not to have to pay taxes, as much taxes, I should say. But yes, I'm glad they're involved. They do a tremendous job. And there are union workers who are helping build this. They're paying union salaries. There's many positive parts of this that are ignored. And one thing I will say, and this is one of the, I meet with a ton of people who are thinking about running for office. And one thing I tell everyone is, you run for office on whatever it is you are talking about. And we were all talking about in 2017, how we can do the types of development over the Rhine in all of our neighborhoods, how we can get 50% of our families out of poverty. And then you get elected and all you have to talk about are soccer stadiums and, music venues at the banks. It's like, you don't get to pick, what the media wants to focus on, what you have to vote on. And so what you ran on and what you wanted to focus on, it's hard to, you have to make sure that you continue to do that work despite the distractions of the day. And they've been soccer stadiums and music venues for the last several years.
I have to say, of all the council members, you do have like a singular body of work that has brought the city forward. Like everybody has, of course, they have like initiatives they want to do that better things. And I think some of the council members were just starting to see what might be the body of their work. But there are so many laws on the books, getting at what equality needs to look at. You have done that. And I don't think that's a surprise to anyone.
Well, I appreciate that because, it's interesting of my colleagues who sometimes get a lot of praise and people really think that they don't do a lot of work. Several of them haven't introduced many, if not at all, actual ideas of their own. And my former colleague, Amy Murray, who I did not enjoy, I don't know that there's many things that I can think of that she introduced as policy ideas that we actually even considered.
Yeah, it's like almost like you're giving Burl a to-do list for me. He's still my boss. I'm still the City Hall reporter. Come on. If I do not bring up the streetcar on this podcast, I will never hear the end of it from Jason.
Sure. Let's talk about it.
You know what? What's in the news right now, right? It's running empty, as we deal with, cleanliness and really, safety.
Yep.
What does the streetcar need to look like next year, the year after? What do you think?
I mean, assuming that's going to be reopened. I mean, look, if we are truly going to deal with a $99 million deficit the next year, which is about a fourth of our budget, knowing that 75% of our budget goes to water, sewers, police, and fire. I don't know that it reopens if we do not get some kind of substantial help from the federal government. That's just the reality. And in addition to it not reopening, we will likely be shutting down all parks, all health centers, rec centers. Your garbage is only getting picked up once a month. I mean, that's the dire situation we're looking at if we don't get assistance from the federal government. And so far, we haven't. But the streetcar, look, I mean, the streetcar has been successful in terms of generating economic development. There are absolutely businesses, GE at the banks, to be a prime example, that have said on the record that they located where they did in the city, brought jobs to the city because of the streetcar route. Now, as a transportation tool, it has not been successful. The ridership numbers are bleak, and it's not okay. So how did it get to where it's at? Well, first of all, we have to remember that it was supposed to go to Uptown. And when John Kasich became governor, he rescinded $50 million for the project, which caused the project to have to only be in downtown, the banks, and over the Rhine. So that's the first start of its failure in terms of a transportation project. The second is it needed to be free from day one. You know, we don't pay most roads are not tolled. You drive on the interstates. You don't think interstates should be generating money. They're a transportation tool, and the streetcar should have been free. It doesn't even generate enough, very much revenue at all to making people pay. So it should be free. The signal prioritizations are a big part of what needs to change, because it doesn't run on schedule. It hasn't run on schedule, and so people can't rely on it. So we need signal prioritization so that it can, when the light turns green, the streetcar can go a few seconds before cars can go. Those are some of the things. You know, I think that there needs to be a nonprofit that helps promote the streetcar. So there's all kinds of things we could be doing. Pub crawls or, you know, park crawls. There's all kinds of creative ideas we could do to help people be motivated to use the streetcar. But, you know, part of that problem is that we don't have a mayor who wanted this project to be successful. He ran to kill the project. One of the first things he did within the first few days was try to stop the project. And only a one vote majority, supermajority, prevented him from doing that. And this is not, it has not been a priority of him to make this project work. He would disagree with that, but we would agree to disagree.
So I do feel like we were heading towards some of those things, yep, with the idea that SORTA wasn't going to run it, right? Like in normal times before the pandemic, right? I do feel like the biggest conversation was going to be like, well, how do we make it free? And how do we, you know, get it to the metrics that it needs to have to be successful? Do you think that's something that's still possible right now when we are facing this budget deficit? Because no budget deficit's ever the number they say it is. But even with federal help, I do fear that number is going to be $40 million. That is a lot of money.
It is
a lot of services.
Our departments are so bare boned. We have been cutting and cutting and cutting, and there's no room to fat. There's no fat. So, you know, the streetcar was going to be announced to be starting to be free on July 1st, before this pandemic. I have no idea what the future lies.
Hold up. You never told me that.
Yes. Yeah, the streetcar was going to be free starting July 1st. We could have actually made it free before then, but the mayor did not want to, because he didn't want it to impact the bus levy by having any kind of conversation about the streetcar. But I have no idea going forward. It is so uncertain with what's happening in the world, and our, you know, we rely almost entirely on the earnings tax. Almost like unlike any other city besides Columbus. And so, you know, people are still having to pay property taxes. People are still paying the sales tax, probably more, especially going grocery shopping. But people are not employed. So many of us are not employed. And so they're not paying earnings tax. And therefore, that's why we're seeing such a large projection of a deficit. And so the future of everything is uncertain until we find out if and when we're going to get anything from the federal government.
It's a lot of wait and see on the budget. Like normally we would be probably having a huge budget discussion right now of like priorities and like the things that would be moving our cities forward. And it's disheartening to have to like look at these things, and depressing, you know, to the idea that the city had to furlough people. That was a really hard list to look at.
We were coming into this budget with the first surplus in the last decade, $29 million surplus. And, you know, that tells you that we've been doing the right thing. Like, you know, for the first time in a decade, we're getting more money in than we expected. And so that was a great thing. And we were, you know, excited about either saving money or restoring the cuts that we've made. But, you know, everything changed at the beginning of March.
Okay. All right. So I feel like I was supposed to be keeping time on this, but that's what Jason does. So I didn't do it. I have to circle back to your three new kitties, just because they're all over social and they're adorable. And I feel like we all need pet and baby pictures right now.
They're playing right now, right around me. So they're a lot of fun. So their names are Dottie, Doe, and Jerry. Doe and Jerry were my grandparents' names. And Dottie, Craig used to call her other cat, Raya, daughter, and then he started calling her Dottie. And then, so we named the one Dottie, and also she's after Dottie Henson, who was the main character in A League of Their Own, which is my favorite movie. And Dottie Henson was based on a real life woman from Cincinnati. So
tell us why it's your favorite movie.
because of the line, Gina Davis. So this is my favorite quote of all time. Gina Davis is the star player. She's the catcher, and Tom Hanks is the coach. And Gina Davis decides that she's going to quit the league. And she says, you know, life is just too hard. I'm supposed to be a wife and a mother, not playing baseball, traveling in the country. And, you know, it's just gotten too hard. And so Tom Hanks says, and this is the quote, it's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hard is what makes it great. And so it's my favorite line because, you know, often at times we feel like we should be doing what we're supposed to be doing or what people tell us we should be doing. And instead, we should be following what motivates us and what is passionate, what we're passionate about, what we want to fight for, what you want to get up and work for every day and know it's going to be hard and know it's going to be difficult and that most people will quit. It will be too hard for most people. But if you can get through it, if you can get through the hard, that you will see that it was the hard that made it great. So that's my favorite line.
I thought you were going to say there's no crying in politics.
Well, you know, there was lots of crying. My colleague, who I now really like, Jeff Pastor, he cried at basically every meeting for our first 6 months of this term, which was interesting. But I think he was proud of, you know, being on city council.
So I got a couple of just quick questions, Sherry. Just
go ahead.
They might be fun. So speaking of your colleagues on council, past and present, who's your favorite member of council to have a beer with?
Probably Yvette. I mean, in the past, yeah, Yvette and I are really good friends, and she loves good beer. And, you know, they go to Arnold's like once a week, every week. And so probably Yvette would be my favorite. We always, Yvette and I were always co-team of what's it called? The Bock Fest. We always judged the Sausage Queen and did the tapping of the beer together. So Yvette probably is my person that I'd like to get a drink with.
All right. And I can't ask you the Skyline versus Gold Star because you don't need.
Well, no, you can ask me that.
All right, Skyline or Gold Star?
Both of them have vegetarian options. For many, many, many reasons, Skyline.
I would figure that. We can get into the ownership of Gold Star later. If you were to nominate someone to be on Cincinnati's Mount Rushmore, who would it be? Besides David Sherry, Crowley, of course.
David Crowley.
David Crowley. Interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's how I got my start in everything. So I worked for David Crowley, ran one of his campaigns, worked for him at City Hall, and he died in January of 2011. That's the year that I ran and won. So an amazing, amazing guy.
And then if there was one thing that you would do differently, you know, hindsight being what it is, what would that be as far as your time on city council? What one thing would you have done differently?
Well, one vote I would have not. So in 2013, when Roxanne was running for mayor against Cranley, she very, in my opinion, this was a very not smart move, was trying to sell our parking system privatize our parking. And while I voted against privatizing parking, I voted yes on the emergency clause, which prevented people from gathering signatures to put that vote up for a referendum. I wish I would have voted against the emergency clause because it was a bad idea and people should have been allowed to collect signatures and try to repeal that vote. But, you know, other things that I've, you know, obviously the whole texting thing, which I think you all are going to ask about, was a mistake. It was a mistake that I made, that my colleagues made, and that I wish we could go back and change. Those are two things that I regret.
Okay.
So I do think, you know, for listeners, we have talked about the texting a lot.
Yeah.
You know, these podcasts are not meant to be a grilling on one subject. Sure. I meant to ask that question actually a lot earlier in this and really talk about that. But your body of work is since 2011, and even before that in the city, it is not one singular item. And that's not to say that was good or bad or weigh in on that, but it is certainly a body of work that is much more than texting.
Yes.
So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a mistake. It wasn't a meaningful mistake. I didn't think that I was breaking the Open Meetings Act, but obviously I was. And, I've apologized for it. And, I hope that people accept my apology.
Burl.
I'm just being quiet in case Jill's trying to wrap us up.
Okay, he definitely is. He'd be using his finger right now. Like, we were in the studio.
Some of our guests can easily be two-parters, and you're one of them, Chris, because there's just so much you've done, so much that you've been involved with. And I think people enjoy just kind of, just hearing you talk about things that, the things that we mentioned you've been at the center of, and just in a more relaxed kind of conversational way, just to hear your thoughts on them in retrospect, I think is very interesting. So I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. And I'm just, sorry that we picked a week that Jason was off, because I'm sure there could have been a little more fireworks, but I think this was good.
I don't know that I would be here if Jason was hosting.
Let's just say it worked out.
It worked out for the way it was supposed to.
All right, Chris, thank you. We'll see you at council.
Well, thank you all for, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it. And, we're all trying to make the city a better place, and you don't have to always agree with each other, but I wish the message of respect, and I have made mistakes, and I've said things that I regret, but if anything, I hope that people understand that we are all people and that we do make mistakes, and that if you can be a little bit more kind to one another, especially on social media. I have a call today, or a Zoom call at 6 o'clock with a guy who I know we're wrapping up, but I just wanted to finish on this. I did a poll on Twitter a week or so ago saying, do you think it would be a good idea to have an open container district in Over the Rhine? And as a result, someone tweeted back at me that that I should just admit that I hate low-income people. And, I reached out to this guy and challenged him. And we're having a Zoom call today at 6 o'clock because, there's so much hate and divisiveness on social media, and it infects all of us, And so I just would ask that, understand that there are always going to be differences. You don't always have to agree with me, but try to be a little bit more kind to one another, especially during these times. And we're all frustrated and stuff. But that would be my one message that I would want to get out to people.
All right. Well, that's a good end question. That's a good ending, right? Because that's true.
It is a good ending. And I would encourage people, if they haven't seen your guest appearance on 5 o'clock Tales with Molly Wellman, as you mentioned her earlier.
Yes.
That's one of the good things that has come out of the pandemic, I think, is the creativity people have had with, carrying on their jobs, their mission, their reason to be via social media. And I thoroughly enjoyed your appearance. And I would have been the guy running back and forth trying to find the stuff too.
Well, and we taped that in the morning, and I'm like, this is the first time I haven't been on vacation that I'm having a cocktail at like 11 a.m.
There's nothing wrong with that.
But it was fun.
All right.
Thank you all. All right. Have a good weekend.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye.
All right. So I feel like we could, you said it at the end, we definitely could have had Chris on for 2 episodes or 10. We hit on a lot of the high points, though. That was a really good conversation about gentrification, though, in our city, and an important one. So that was kind of fun to like really delve into an issue, the three of us. But that was serious. And so much is serious now in the pandemic. I mean, what do we really care about? And I feel like I saw it on your social media in the last couple of days in passing, and that's cookies.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think I was unfairly targeted by Lauren in this whole cookie controversy that she created on Facebook. So she's a great cook. She likes to say, if it's on the stove and in a skillet and it involves pasta and spices and seasoning and olive oil and wine and everything. You know, that's her zone. But I asked her, I said, how come you don't bake cookies? It would be great if we had some cookies. And she's like, oh, I hate anything to do with the oven. I can't deal with it. And so she decided to take it as this challenge. And so she, long story short, she had asked me, like, well, what kind should I make? And I was like, well, you know, chocolate chip cookies are good. You could make snickerdoodles. And she's like, who eats snickerdoodles? And I was like, what do you mean? Snickerdoodles are good. What's wrong with snickerdoodles? So she puts on Facebook this, like, you know, question about snickerdoodles. And I didn't realize it's such a divisive topic. Either you really, really love them or you hate on them. And I don't get it. So what do you think about the much maligned snickerdoodle?
I have to, it was a little bit of a nostalgia for me because, you know, I come from a time where we had home ec in seventh and eighth grade. And, you know, one of the first things you did is make snickerdoodles and like learn how to bake. And so I do like them and they're a happy memory for me, but I think they're almost like a forgotten cookie. I know this conversation is not that important in the scheme of things, but it is also true. Snickerdoodles are forgotten. It's just not the ones I think that people, you know, go to make. Did you guys end up making them?
No, she didn't make the snickerdoodles. She decided to do chocolate chip cookies, and it took two tries. The first batch, they didn't at all spread on the pan. They just stayed like in rock form. They were okay. And then she called her mom, because what do you do when you're struggling making cookies? You phone a friend.
Absolutely.
She got some tips and then turned out a great batch of perfect chewy chocolate chip cookies. So no snickerdoodles. But in a That's So Cincinnati moment on this Facebook thread, a friend of ours named Natalie, who used to be the communications person at the art museum back in the day, she said, if you don't like snickerdoodles, you've never had a snickerdoodle from Vonderhaar's Catering, which supplies the cookies for the Cincinnati Playhouse. And I thought, there you go. You know, there's always some Cincinnati tie to anything you're talking about. And I got to tell you, I've not tried the Vonderhaar's Catering.
It begs the question, are they doing takeout?
Maybe
I will research that.
But yeah, that I just, you know, who knew that, you know, snickerdoodles are sort of like Cincinnati chili. You either love them or you hate them. There's not much middle ground. So I guess that was sort of our Cincinnati moment of the week.
I did say to Alex, I was like, you know, there's a question about what the best cookie is. And I was like, I was unclear. It's a pandemic. I thought the question was, where are the cookies?
What's your go-to cookie?
Jack likes chocolate chip cookies and homemade ones. And Alex is an excellent baker. So I'm like lemon squares. Like if he's going to make something, I was like, well, what about those?
Lemon square.
The Martha Stewart recipe, it has like 3 pounds of butter in it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Well,
Go ahead. The sweet that I miss is Holtman's. We really don't live close to the Oakley one. And you do bring them into the office on Thursday morning. So that's been like the worst thing about working at home.
And, you
not
know,
homeschooling,
I
not
miss,
the dog.
I miss my people at Holtman's. You know, I go there, the one in Over the Rhine, I had been going every Thursday to pick up donuts. That's my thing. Bring donuts to the newsroom on Thursday. Unless I'm not coming into the office, and then you guys are so, you know, Pavlovian trained to donuts, I have to make sure someone brings them in if I'm not there. But the people that work at Holtman's are hilarious. And we have this ongoing thing where, I don't know if you've ever gone to Holtman's, but they have their sort of like regular donuts that cost whatever they cost. And then they have the specialties, you know, those are the maple bacon donuts that have real bacon on top. They have the like the cookie crisp donuts, like the donuts that have like the cereal on top, and they're like literally the top shelf donuts. And so when you order a dozen donuts, they ask you two questions. They say, do you have any nut allergies? And I always say no, because we don't, that I'm aware of. No one's complained yet.
We haven't killed anybody that I know
That's
of.
Right. And then they say, do you want any specialties? And I always say, no, I'm too cheap. My folks can just have the regular donuts. And they give me such a hard time. Like I'm this big cheapskate that, you know, I don't care about you all because I don't splurge on the specialties. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm in here every Thursday buying donuts and you're calling me cheap and saying I don't care about my, you know, my team. So I think when I'm able to do Donut Thursday again, I'm going to do an all specialties dozen just to make up for my cheapness.
So here's what we're going to know. We're going to know if Carl listens to this podcast to the very end, if he asks you about this, and I will know. I cannot wait to see.
It'll be good. And, you know, it's not just the newsroom. The lovely ladies that work in our, you know, that do the security and are in the fortress in our lobby, they would watch me walk in with the donuts every Thursday, and I felt guilty, so I started to offer them donuts. So now they expect it. Like, if I'm not there, they're like, where were you yesterday? It was Thursday. So I've kind of created a monster with this.
But I occasionally bring donuts to City Hall, and I never forget about the guards who, you know, sit at the front, mostly because I feel like they're the most important people in City Hall because they keep me safe. No offense to council or the mayor. So I try not to forget about them, or the person who helps me park my car, like by the courthouse, because I'm a terrible like backer inner of like really big parking lots, and they help me, and so I never forget about them.
Yep. Well, this would have been the season too. I would have to up my order a little bit because the interns would have been in the newsroom. Now we still have interns, but we're all still working mostly from home. But yeah, the last summer was when I realized that when we have 6 or 8 interns running around, I have to up that donut order.
Intriguing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there you have it.
All right, Burl, thanks for doing this with me. It's so good to talk to you.
You too, Sherry. You stay safe.
All right, Philly, I miss you.
I miss you guys too.
All right, I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
All right, thanks, guys.